evening and I do.
Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
Potatoes, yeah.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. How are you doing this weekend? Do you have whiplash from this weather? I was in Marin yesterday. It was almost 100. And then a glorious 59 degrees as I drove to the farmer's market in Sebastopol this morning. So I heard a few people complaining, saying, oh, my body's so confused. But I love that. I love this cool weather. Cool weather and great summer produce at the market today. I saw the first orange and yellow raspberries. The red raspberries have been around for a while, but now they, Sebastopol Berry Farm had those fabulous baskets that are all the mixed colors. So good. And they also had black raspberries, which you don't see all that often. They're delicate. They're hard to find. People don't necessarily know what to do with them. I eat them. And we're going to find out what my guest likes to do with them, because I have a feeling she loves them. Returning for at least the third time, possibly the fourth time, it is the fabulous Stephanie Rosenbaum, one of my personal favorite food writers. Up from San Francisco more often lately. That's great. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
And you give me a great opportunity. I was trying to figure out, when is the last time I did Donuts and Whole here on Mouthful? And it was at least 11 years ago.
Well, high time. Bring on the Donuts and definitely bring on the Whole.
Yeah, I think that was the last time. But we had somebody here from who now I'm in a group with, somebody who dances hula. And at that time, she and her husband had a malasada business.
Oh.
And it's the first time I had malasadas, and they were in the kitchen cooking malasadas.
That's
and
amazing.
Bringing them in with all these different toppings.
What kinds of toppings do they put on their malasadas?
There was a chocolate syrup, jalapia, cinnamon sugar, powdered sugar. I'm sort of a purist, you know. Cinnamon sugar or powdered sugar
Sugar's
is fine.
But
don't get anything gooey on my malasadas. So the new book, World of Donuts, with more than 50 delicious recipes from donuts around the world. And donuts are one of the fried dough with something sweet. It's something that you find in almost every culture, isn't it?
Yeah, I found it. The donuts are, you know, things along the lines of a donut where that was absolutely universal. You know, there may be some cultures out there that don't fry sweet dough, but I couldn't find them.
Uh-huh.
Really, you know, different flavors, different tastes, but really definitely everywhere. Everybody loves and makes some kind of a sweet fried dough treat.
Mm-hmm. And did you find out the genesis of some of those? I mean, is some of it that they have dough left over from making other things, so they just fry it up? Because I figured that.
That's what I think. And, of course, there's a lot of the European ones, you know, usually often use a yeast dough, and then you fatten it up. You know, you add butter to it, or you add dried fruit, or you add spices, things like that. And then it becomes a treat, and it becomes something that you'd have for special occasions, for fair days, or for, you know, for especially around Carnival, you know, before Lent and things like that. So it's not that hard to make. If you have fat around, it's not too hard. You know, you fry something up. I think it's something you can do. You don't have to bake it. You don't need a bake oven, you know, things like that. If you're kind of thinking about, you know, going further back, you know, several centuries when people didn't necessarily have home ovens as much. It's a kind of like in an itinerant sort of cooking, because basically you need a fire and you need a pot and you need fat.
Yeah.
And anybody can, you know, make a donut. So it's actually pretty simple.
Do you have a long history, personal history with donuts?
I do. I love donuts. Growing up on the East Coast, we used to go up apple picking every fall, and we would always go to the places that had apple cider donuts. And so they were a cake donut made with a little apple cider in the batter and then rolled in cinnamon sugar. And so pretty much all the apple picking places would be making these hot, fresh, you know, right in front of you as you're drinking your apple cider and eating these as well. And I think I had these up in apple country up in, what is that, around Placerville, up in the kind of gold country area.
Okay.
And I think Rainbow Orchards was there 1 year, and they were making apple cider donuts, which was delicious.
Yeah,
and
so that's brand new to me. I had not heard of apple cider donuts.
Oh, they're great. They're very, very East Coast thing, but they're wonderful. And so there is a recipe in the book for them.
I have to make a confession. When I was in, I think, junior high, Lark seems to be wanting to chime in about donuts, but you don't get to, little girl. For one winter, I can't remember which winter it was, but it was junior high, me and my best friend Carol, I would twist my mother's arms and we would get those Pillsbury things of donuts, you know, the kind you pop it.
Right, yeah, you pop like the cup. Pop it and, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a dozen donuts with their holes, but cut, so you could take them out.
So you could just fry them?
And we would, and I just remember it was winter and it was cold, and we would come home after school, and we would make donuts and eat donuts. And
it's,
I just love
it's
that.
So much fun. And so we used to get the apple cider donuts, and then when we used to go up to Nantucket Island in the summertime, and there was a great place called the Downy Flake, and it's actually still there. It's in a different space than it was when we were kids, but they had a huge donut sign about the size of a truck tire hanging outside their window, and so we used to always get donuts there. And then when I moved here, I was actually writing an article for San Francisco Magazine about where to get the best donuts in the Bay Area. I was not impressed by the donuts that I had until a friend of mine who lived in Marin said, "Oh, you got to go to Donut Alley in Larkspur. It's been there forever." She went there as a high school student. It's still there, and I think their donuts are wonderful. They open really early in the morning, and they close, and the donuts run out, which is generally before noon. And it's just the little donut shop that you love, you know, with the coffee and the donuts and the guy, you know, it's a family run business. Uh-huh. They've had it forever. And I think their donuts are really great. So,
what kind of donuts? What are their specialties?
I am a cake donut person.
Right on. I was plain cake. That was always my favorite. Plain cake, or the raised donuts, I guess you would call the other ones, raised with just granulated sugar. But I really liked plain cake donuts.
I'm a cinnamon sugar or chocolate glaze on the, you know, a little chocolate glaze on the cake donut. Yeah, I'd never have liked the raised donut. I know some people really like the buttermilk bars, you know, things like that. But I don't know, are there other places in Sonoma that you love for donuts? Restaurants that are doing good donuts or places that you know of?
There is, and you have to try this now that you spend more time up here. Do you know Parish Cafe?
No.
Oh, Parish Cafe. Rob Lippincott. I was actually going to see if he could sneak up and join us tonight, but I know that I think he gave a cooking demonstration at the Windsor Farmers Market today, and his restaurant, it's a big day for the restaurant, so I thought I'm not going to bother him. But his family's from Louisiana, and he was selling beignets at farmers markets all over Sonoma County.
Oh, wonderful.
And now he opened his restaurant several months ago. And you know what? We're going to talk about Rob in just a minute, but the show is called Donuts and Hole. So we're going to go to a little bit of Hole, and I'm going to calm down the puppy.
I'm over there.
Yep, that's the theme tonight, donuts and whole. It's really shameful how much I amuse myself with that. I'm talking to Stephanie Rosenbaum. She's written more than just this new book, World of Donuts. Honey from Flower to Table was your first, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember you came on then. And then the delightful little astrology cookbook, A Cosmic Guide to Feasts of Love. It is so fun, and the cover is just so great. So we are talking about donuts. We're talking about Rob Lippincott. So he's got this little... not that little, but great restaurant, Parish Cafe, Cajun food. It's open during the day only. I think it's Wednesday through Sunday. And beignets are on the menu throughout the week.
Oh, yum.
So those are the best donuts. There's a couple mm-hmm. of restaurants every now and then that will have beignets on their menu. Mm-hmm. But right now in Sonoma County, can't think of anyone that has them regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And the Aloha festivals, you know, we always hope that the Malasada stand will be
right.
there. And then there was a guy, Mark Carter, who I run into at the farmer's market quite a lot. You would be interested in him. He had an organic donut wholesale business for a while.
Okay.
He came on, brought lots of donuts, and he was making them himself, all organic ingredients, getting up at 3 or 4 in the morning, delivering them to all these locations. And I think he wanted to go big.
Mm-hmm.
I think he wanted to go big and possibly sell so it could go mm-hmm. big. And he just said he got tired of getting up at 3 every morning, and he retired the company after a couple of years. But those were good. Those were very nice.
I bet. But yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot of work in the service of the donut.
Yeah. So talk about what you brought, because you don't want it to sit for too long.
Right. I thought about, you know, you and your deep roots in hula, and I thought I should make some malasada. But then I thought, ooh, I don't know if I can do that, because, you know, I haven't been to Hawaii, and, you know, I figured they wouldn't necessarily be as authentic as they could be. So I went with what you requested, which are beignets.
Oh, you know, and I was just bouncing back and forth with you.
Okay.
I was just saying, malasada.
Yes. So I took that as make me beignets. So
oh gosh,
they're actually very similar, don't you think?
They are very similar, absolutely. And you know, I have to tell you, the very best malasadas I've ever had have been here.
Really?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. They've been at the Aloha Festival. There's one vendor. They're just so
really, really good.
So good. I've had really good ones in Honolulu as well. But I have to say, the really famous malasada stand on the north shore of Hawaii Moku, the big mm-hmm. island, they're good, but they're a little doughy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember there was a Hawaiian restaurant in the Castro whose name is escaping me now, but it's no longer there. It's maybe where Francis is now or something. Mm-hmm. And they used to have great malasadas. And that was my introduction to malasadas. So I think they're delicious. But, you know, having been down, of course, to the Crescent City and had the beignets at Café du Monde. So these are, you know, my interpretation of them. So, yes, I just fried these up, I don't know, about an hour ago for you. So
do you ever get the beignet mix?
I have, and it's actually good. It's a little bland,
uh-huh.
you know. So I actually, you know what I've done with it more than making? I've made beignets, and I'm like, these kind of don't taste like much. But I've used it as a fritter batter. So you make it wetter. So that it's like a mm-hmm. goopy. It's a goopy batter, and then you take slices of apple and you dip it in that, and you deep fry that.
Oh, what a great idea!
And then you roll it in cinnamon sugar, and so it makes this actually really crunchy fritter batter. Mm-hmm. So that's actually, I think, the best thing to do with mm-hmm. if you have a box of that beignet mix is use it for fritters.
I used to use it every Christmas morning
mm-hmm.
when both my daughters were in town. We had malasadas, and it was just a
Yum.
Tradition to use that.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. No, I would think I was staying somewhere on the beach or something. And it was like one of those rented houses where there's just random stuff in the cabinet.
Oh,
and I'm like,
and there it is.
Oh, look, there's a box of beignet mix. What can I do with this? So
these are really nice.
Oh, thank you. I know we need a little cafe au lait with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I
oh,
see,
yeah.
actually, I can see that you have spilled sugar down your front.
So they should.
They are absolutely authentic now.
Absolutely. Did you run across... As you searched, did you run across any savory donuts?
Yes, I definitely did. And I, you know, things made with lentil flour, especially mm-hmm. Indian and in Asia and things. But I ended up thinking if I go down that route, then it's like the book is going to be the encyclopedia of donuts,
sure.
you know. And so I kept it to sweet.
Sweets,
but definitely
yeah.
there's lots and lots of savory, you know, little fried morsels. For
yeah,
sure.
you see savory beignets now and then.
Oh,
I think
really?
I've seen shrimp beignets or corn
yes.
beignets or something
Brenda's,
like that.
Brenda's in San Francisco does, I think, a crawfish beignet, and I think mm-hmm. they do a shrimp beignet, and they do, you know, so you just do the same. It's basically like
the
a
same,
white
but
bread
without
type,
the sugar.
Without the sugar, and you can fill it a lot of times with something savory.
Yeah.
And sometimes people will fry it and then kind of, you know, claw out the middle and put in something.
Right.
Make it like a little box and put in something savory. So you could definitely do that.
I think, I don't know if they've take anything out or if they just inject, but some some of the really popular malasadas in Honolulu are filled.
Oh, right.
Some are filled with haupia. I'm still a I'm a purist.
Right. Right. But
nothing messed up. Nothing messing with my fried dough.
Oh.
What about in Southeast Asia?
Oh, well, we've got some really interesting ones in there, some from India, and then some, I think there's a sesame ball, but it's actually, which is, I think, Thai, and is filled with a red bean paste.
That's like something you also see in
dim sum places,
dim sum,
too.
Yes,
right.
I love that.
Yeah, so that was, so that's in this section. And, of course, those are ban kham, so those are them.
There
they're
they
not,
are.
They're not really sweet. It's interesting because when you keep going east and you go through the Mediterranean and the Near East, things get really sweet, as you know.
Yeah.
Greece and Turkey. And you know,
they have really, really sweet syrups on them,
yeah,
right?
So usually they're fried and then they're soaked in a honey, usually a honey syrup or a sugar syrup that's usually infused with spices, you know, cardamom and things like that. Or rose. Rose and orange. I have some Moroccan donuts that have orange in them and things like that. And then, you know, so really, sweet. And then as you go kind of further and you hit India, wow, that's really sweet. And then when you kind of move up into Asia, all of a sudden a lot of that sugar drops out and it's a little, they're not quite savory, but it definitely not the huge sweet tooth. And in fact, there are those kind of crullery things that people that are savory, they're not sweet, and that people use with kanji and with juk, that it's used a lot as a dip into.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So it's like they're actually stuck together and they're these kind of long crullers and people use, but they're not sweet, and people use those as like we would use a breadstick.
Okay.
And they dip that.
I love juk and kanji. I love it.
Yeah.
But I never saw that. I was only in Malaysia.
Oh, okay.
They didn't have that option.
Right.
But that's really interesting. Did you go? Did you find anything in Russia?
No, I don't. I don't think I ended up with any with any Russian donuts. There is a puchki, which is a Polish donut, which is big in especially around before Lent, and it's big in Poland, but also in Polish American communities out here. So lots of. I seem like there was actually. Just a handful of variations of doughs. You know, you had a kind of baking powder type dough, like a muffin dough, and then you had a regular yeast dough, and then you had basically like a pâte à choux, you know, where you add the eggs in one by one to the hot dough, and those, and maybe another slight variation, and then that was pretty much it. You know, all the ingredients are actually pretty straightforward, and the techniques are pretty straightforward. And I realized that, I was like, oh, okay, everything's just subtle flavoring variations on very similar doughs. Because there's only so many ways to invent a wheel, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. There's one in here that I don't know if you invented it or not, but it caught my eye right away. You have to tell us about the maple bacon.
Oh, the maple bacon. Yes. Well, that recipe is definitely... I took that recipe and I really wanted to run with it because I think maple bacon, you know, bacon, everybody loves bacon. You know, there's bacon martinis, there's bacon gum, there's, you know...
I know, the bacon martinis... I guess.
So there's your chocolate bacon. There's, you know, bacon in your chocolate bar. So I thought, and of course, maple bacon donuts have, you know, shown up. It's like a pancake, you know, but in a donut. And so I thought, but a lot of times it's just a regular cream-filled donut with a piece of bacon stuck on top. And I thought, well, we can do better than that.
Yeah, you can do way better than
that. Right. So actually, this one has a bacon-infused pastry cream and then a actual real maple, you know, maple syrup glaze. And then I think there's actually bacon on top. So it's extra bacony and extra maple-y. It's all the way through. It's not just bacon on top.
Yeah, well, it really caught my eye because in my book, Vinaigrettes, I have a maple bacon vinaigrette.
Oh, I bet that's delicious.
And I thought of it for... it goes really well with sweet potatoes.
Oh, of course.
And so many people cook sweet potatoes way too sweet.
Mm-hmm.
So for years I've been trying to come up with different things to do, and I did a sweet potato salad with onions and I think toasted pecans and then a maple bacon vinaigrette.
That sounds so great.
It's enough sweetness, but it's not that overly
sugary. Yeah. You could probably use roasted like butternut squash or something too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I do a number of things with it, but I noticed that with reviewers, that's one of the ones that's capturing a lot of reviewers' attention.
Oh, that sounds great.
Mentioning it. And so I saw that and I was like, maybe I need some maple bacon donuts to dip into my maple bacon vinaigrette. On that note, maestro.
Doll mouth, doll legs, I am doll arms, big veins, doll babe. Yeah, they really want you, they really want you, they really do. Yeah, they really want you, they really want you, I do too. I want to be the girl with the most cake. I love him so much, it just turns to hate. I fake it so real, I am beyond fake. Someday you will ache like I ache. Someday you will ache like I ache.
It's Michelle Anna Jordan here with Stephanie Rosenbaum, the girl with the most cake. Let's talk about what you do other than just writing this book. So let's get a broader scope, because I know you do a blog for KQED, right?
Talk
about that.
Oh, it's called Bay Area Bites, and it's actually a bunch of different writers in the Bay Area. So we all, probably a stable of, I don't know, half a dozen of us or so, who write about, you know, sort of all different kinds of things of what's going on in the food world in and around the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's personal recipes and personal essays, and sometimes it's interviews with chefs, and sometimes it's events and, you know, all kinds of things. I know one of our writers just went to a foraging a dinner that was all was all about foraged food, and you know, all kinds of. We just sort of look for whatever is interesting and interesting going on in and around.
See, I follow you, right? I hadn't noticed there were other writers.
Yeah, so I usually about once a week, I have a piece in there. So. I've been doing that since 2009, so it's great. I love doing it because, you know, it's wonderful to work with KQED, but it's also really nice because it always gives me a place to write about all different kinds of things that are going on. And whenever you hear about something, you can write about it.
Yeah, that's so important for a writer, I think.
Definitely. And we also, you know, because it's KQED, we want it to be some news-based, and so we definitely look at, you know, advocacy for sustainable seafood forces, you know, for our local artisans, all kinds of things that that we care about, that we want to see continue in the Bay Area, and issues that people are concerned with.
Yeah. And then you reviewed restaurants for about the same amount of time as I did, I think.
Yeah, about 15 years. Yeah. I started in 94 and did it probably about till I left San Francisco. So, you know, which was maybe in 2003. So a good long time, first for the Bay Guardian and then for San Francisco Magazine.
Right. And I was first, well, I was first with a couple of papers up here, and then I was at San Francisco Magazine.
Right.
I don't think we overlapped.
No, I came on when Tori Ritchie became the food editor
there. Oh, I was there for a while.
Yeah, I was, but,
you know, change of staff. Yeah. You often don't survive.
Yep, exactly.
But that's okay, because I love being at the Press Democrat, where I don't review restaurants.
No, but you've got a great column there.
I love not reviewing restaurants, and I actually have 4 columns a week now.
Oh, my goodness. That's crazy. That's great.
4 columns a week, plus a blog as often as I can.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what that's like. Right. So what else are you working on these days?
Well, I just finished another book. So this has been a busy year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And this is also for the same press, for Egg and Dart Press, which is a new press.
Where are they located?
They are... East Coast based, I think, in Florida. And so, anyway, so this is called The Art of Vintage Cocktails, and it is a really cute, kind of gifty book that
Well, your books are all so cute.
Thank you.
You're a total girly girl, and I mean that in the best possible way. You're also a curly girl. I love your style.
And
that comes into your writing, I think, in just the most genuine way. You know, so I can see you totally doing vintage cocktails.
It was really a lot of fun. And I think it's actually an illustrated book. So it doesn't have photographs, but each cocktail is illustrated. And it kind of has a little bit about each kind of era of the cocktails. And then each cocktail has a bit of history and a bit of the story. Because I just found it to be so interesting to find out the stories behind these cocktails. And there's always like the obvious story. Then you dig a little deeper and then there's the real story.
Yeah, that's true with so much.
Right. Don't you find that with food? Definitely.
Oh, with food, but also with almost anything. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating when you sort of lift up the rug and look underneath.
I know. And just like with food, especially with cocktails, it wasn't just about what was this cocktail. It was what was news, what was happening in the economy, what was happening, you know, world politics. Like, it actually, everything sort of came together to influence what people were drinking. Yeah. So I found that really interesting. So I tried to work as much of that into a very small, cute gift book as I possibly could.
Is Rachel Maddow involved?
She should be.
You should get a blurb
from her. I know I did not name drop her in the book, but I should have. But
get a blurb.
I am dreaming of getting a blurb from her. I don't know if anybody knows her. Send them my way.
Well, we know that she went to school in Hayward?
Oh, right.
I think it was Hayward.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be that hard to find somebody.
Right. And did she go to Yale? I surely...
I'm not sure if she went to Yale or not.
I'm not sure
I know
where
more
she
about,
went. Right.
But you hear people talking about, I knew her in high school.
Right.
So that, for her, it wasn't that
long ago. I know.
And...
Yes.
I haven't seen her do a cocktail moment recently,
but she definitely has. And I've seen her making wonderful, wonderful cocktails. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I'm really hoping that we can get something out of her.
Yeah.
But is
the Sazerac in your book?
Oh, of course.
So tell us, you know, I'm interested in the Sazerac just because I have this fascination with absinthe.
Right. Well, you know, the Sazerac really, I wish I had the book in front of me because I don't have all the details, but Peychaud's Bitters, which was actually Antoine Peychaud, who invented this bitters that was a medicinal drink, and that he had a pharmacy and he sold these bitters. And then it was originally, I believe, he suggested mixing it with cognac, which was sort of the drink of the day in the 1800s. And then eventually, I guess it got replaced by bourbon, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so because, you know, I don't know, cognac fell out of fashion. And so, yeah, so then originally the glass was rinsed with absinthe.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, when absinthe was outlawed, and I believe 1912, then they switched over to Herb Saint, which is a similar pastille, except that it doesn't have the wormwood in it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so it's, I believe it's bourbon and bitters and absinthe and, I can't remember what else is in it.
Is it lemon?
Lemon or lime?
And maybe a little simple syrup? I know that that's one of the, that's, I think the first one I saw Rachel Maddow make.
Was a Sazerac?
She would do those sometimes on Friday. And
right.
I think she actually was broadcasting from New Orleans.
Oh, how great.
And that's how she did it initially. But I think I've seen her do it also in the studio.
Right.
And she really needs to bring back her cocktail moments.
No, definitely. So, but, yeah, I love the Sazerac. And, of course, the Ramos Gin Fizz.
Yeah.
You know, which was another wonderful drink. And actually, the original bar that made it would have actually a line of Shaker Boys. And that
really?
Were actually, like, imagine, like, a dozen, you know, strapping young men behind the bar.
Shaking.
So every time you ordered a fizz, one would shake it, and then he'd pass it to the next.
Oh, so.
And they would shake.
All the way down the line.
And then the last Shaker Boy would then pour it.
Oh, if I could only
can you
cue
imagine?
Up Shake Your Booty right now.
I know. So that was, it was like a chorus line of strapping Shaker Boys.
That is great.
I loved that as an image. So that would be worth ordering that drink just to watch.
Absolutely. Oh, maybe your book will launch a new chorus line. Have you been out to Rocker Oysterfellers out in Valley Forge?
Not lately, but I feel like every time I'm out here, somebody is recommending it and talking
about
how good it is.
But they make Sazeracs there.
Oh.
They have absinthe.
We'll have to go.
Yeah.
Because, you know, now, of course, you can get absinthe.
Yeah, I know. I have a closet full or a cupboard full.
Wonderful.
I actually got some before it became legal.
Oh, right. From someone you knew from Burning Man or from Czechoslovakia? Or where did you?
Interesting. Because I'd been writing about absinthe. I wrote about absinthe a little bit in graduate school because that was my time period.
Mm-hmm.
Oscar Wilde, you know.
Right. Of course, the Green Fairy. Yeah.
Yeah. And then in the movie, in the Francis Coppola movie, there's a great scene with the Green Fairy. So I was really interested in it, and to me it was just this elusive thing that I would never ever
taste. Have right
and
sure.
Then all of a sudden it's like, what? And I had a secretary at the time, and she walked in and she says, I have a present for you. And she presented me with this whiskey box, and it was all perfectly sealed. It was Japanese whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
I opened it up, and there was a bottle of Japanese absinthe inside.
Oh my goodness.
And she had friends who went to Japan and did this and brought it back so she could give it to me.
That's incredible.
And I thought it was the only bottle I would ever have, and I didn't open it for like 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did my experiment with it on an empty stomach during Hale-Bopp Comet. I got all the right implements, I got some absinthe spoons.
The sugar and the spoons, yeah.
And, I felt like, I don't know if it was Aldous Huxley or one of those people who would take a drug and then try to observe themselves and the effect. And it was very interesting. And I don't think I'd read Barnaby Conrad Jr.'s book about absinthe yet. And in it, he shows that the active molecule of wormwood has just one or two hydrogen bonds different than THC.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
So there's this amazing similarity.
Sure.
And there is there's a similar
effect.
Similar effect.
Because it's the thujone, right? That's the active component, right?
Yeah, and it's that element that THC has that's physical, where time is slightly elongated. I guess that's psychological. That time is slightly elongated. Colors, especially in the green spectrum, are intensified. But you feel this on your skin. You feel this lovely, it's like you have velvet just under your skin. And there was a man here in Sonoma County, I'll think of his name in a minute, but he had, probably still has, the wine shop over in the town of Sonoma. And he had this amazing collection of original absinthe posters.
Oh.
He started collecting them. And I wrote about him quite a bit. And that intensification of color, you could start seeing that.
Right.
It's like, oh, that's what this is about. That's what they're seeing. So anyway, I did my little experiment, and then it was close to a decade before it became legal.
Legal, right.
And now it's like, geez, you can just walk into a store
and just
buy it.
I know. It's amazing. Yeah, yeah. I definitely had friends who were in that kind of Burning Man community who, somebody was always brewing it. A lot of people said, oh, it was murky awfulness. They were
stuff.
Just dreadful. Distilling is a very precise process, and it's not really something you should try at home. So I never tried any of those, but I definitely heard about it.
Yeah,
so
I
think it's
them.
Actually, we're all lucky that it's now legal and it's being made by people who actually know what they're doing.
Supposedly, there's a guy who lives in Sonoma County who's making his own absinthe.
Oh.
possibly with the intention of eventually taking it public. And he's been asking me to come over and try it for several years. And one of these days I will.
Definitely.
It's just like to think about going somewhere to try absinthe implies getting back
from that place
somewhere
to
try absinthe.
Right.
And that just isn't appealing.
Unless he has a velvet couch you can recline on for a few hours. Definitely.
So when will the Vintage Cocktail book be out?
That will be out this fall. And there's another actually.
Wow, that's soon.
Yeah, believe me, I wrote it really fast.
How fast?
Oh, 2 months.
Like, okay, yeah, that's about how long it took me to write the Vinaigrette book. And, you know, I love writing a book that fast.
Yeah, I actually really liked it. And I was actually sad when I finished it because I had to keep turning in chunks of it because they were smart and they wanted it, you know, piece by piece. Uh-huh. And so I got really used to just being in that literally soaking in those, you know, all that history. And I loved it. And I was like, when I finished, I was like, oh, I'm a little sad. I want to write about more cocktails.
I'm always a little sad when I finish a book. Mm-hmm. There's that creative letdown.
Yeah, no, definitely. But there's a one wonderful drink called the Brain Duster that is a little bit, I'm trying to think what, it's like a Manhattan, but it has absinthe in it. So, it's kind of a knock you over kind of drink, but it is wonderful. I think it's bourbon or rye. I think it's rye and sweet vermouth and absinthe and...
Yum.
Things
that sounds
like that.
Good. I heard about something. I wrote it down. It's a corpse razor.
Oh, the corpse reviver. Corpse reviver number
corpse
two.
What is that? That just, whatever it was, it sounded so good. I have notes in my office somewhere.
That also has absinthe in it. I think you can either add it or you can rinse the glass, one or the other.
Okay.
But the corpse reviver was, it was something that was actually a category of drink, similar to like a fizz or a sour, things like that. So they were meant to be eye openers. They were literally meant to be the wake you up, hair of the dog, you know, get you over your hangover kind of drink. And so there was actually a whole, if you look in old cocktail books, there was actually a whole section of corpse survivors, none of which were all the same. You know, there was the number one, the number two, the number three.
Uh-huh.
And for some reason, the number two has lasted. And that tends to be the one that you now find in trendy cocktail bars.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So the corpse reviver. But what was very funny, this guy, Harry Craddock, who was wrote the Savoy cocktail book in 1930, and he said, beware, because four of these taken in quick succession will unrevive the corpse again.
Did you have to deal? So you probably didn't have to deal with a lot of the contemporary.
No, you know, I would love to do the art of craft cocktails and get into the people's intriguing inventions, but these were all pretty much
the classic ones, the Manhattan, the little black dress of cocktails.
Oh, absolutely. So things like that. And I also tried to get into slightly, you know, some wacky obscure ones that hopefully people haven't heard of. But excuse me, but I was not doing the, you know, Fernet, you know, six kinds of bitters, Amaro. Yeah.
Or Long Island iced tea either.
Right.
I assume.
No. So I was not doing either the really obvious ones or the, you know, the super invented new contemporary cocktails.
Yeah, cool. We'll be right back. I think it's time for a little more Hole.
I tell you everything. And I hope that you won't tell. Not give you anything. I know that you won't tell on me. P girl gets the belt. Your milk makes me mine. Your milk is so sour.
Yeah.
Yeah, the songs tonight by Hole from the classic album Live Through This. I think it's one of the best albums ever made. You know, definitely on the top 100, maybe even in my top 10. Talking with Stephanie Rosenbaum. It's always so much fun to talk with you, Stephanie. And there is powdered sugar everywhere, and that's okay. So the book is the book World of Donuts. It's just come out.
It's just come out. Yeah, just came out this week, pretty much.
Okay.
So it's brand.
It came out in time for National Donut Day.
I know. Which actually has a background. I feel like do you get press releases for National Iced Tea Day and National, you know, like Chicken Cacciatore Day and, you know, things like that. I get those every day.
Yeah, and usually they are about a food that is not in season at that time naturally, because they're trying to lift. Sales
for something
when you shouldn't be buying them anyway.
Yes, absolutely.
National BLT Day is in April.
Try getting a good tomato then. Right. But the actual was actually put together by the Salvation Army in the Depression in 1938 in honor of the women who had worked in the been in the trenches, not in the trenches, but in the near the front lines of supporting the troops in World War I, making donuts. So actually that was one of the things that the women who were working for the Salvation Army and the Red Cross were doing through World War I and World War II was making donuts in these really, really rudimentary field kitchens, trying to, you know, feed the guys and get some calories in them. And, of course, also feeding the, you know, women who were working as nurses and as support throughout the war. And, it was incredibly hard. You can imagine trying to fry in incredibly trying conditions.
Yeah.
But they did it. And it was something that I think all the people who were soldiers who came back were very thankful for.
God, I wish I'd known that in advance. I would write about it. I'll write about it next year.
Yeah, definitely. That's so it's actually one of the few national such and such days that is not just a cheap marketing ploy.
Right.
I actually commemorate something important.
Yeah. I like National Sneak Some Zucchini on Your Neighbor's Porch,
Day. Yes, I've seen that for
April 8th.
Sure.
That one is really fun.
In fact, I will be making zucchini fritters at the Berkeley Farmers Market on Tuesday afternoon.
Oh, great.
So, because they were a little, it being the, you know, the Ecology Center, they were a little horrified to know that I was promoting a donut book.
Oh, of course.
Because they were like, can you make those out of kale? Well, they didn't say that, but that was the impression. I was like, no, I understand. I will make donut, I'll make something with a vegetable in it, and then I'll just sell the donut book under the counter. You know?
Right.
So I will be frying, but they will be zucchini fritters.
That's so funny. that's so Bay Area.
I know.
You'd have the same reaction in Sebastopol.
Oh, definitely. I know.
So you just did a TV show.
Hallmark Channel.
I don't know much about.
Neither do I, but I guess it's a very family-friendly channel.
One
would think it's sort of like Lifetime, but not so risque,
right?
None
of those domestic violence dramas,
right? Exactly. But what was very funny was that one of the hosts was this woman, Christina Ferrari, who we're a little bit of the same era. She was a supermodel.
Yeah.
She was a supermodel in the '80s,
supermodel.
And she was married to John DeLorean. So she was as '80s as you can possibly get. And I remember thinking she was a fabulous supermodel. And there I was on set with her making donuts.
I saw the pictures. You look fabulous.
Oh.
You made me want to go out and get all my vintage aprons and give them to you.
Thank you. I would take them.
I would have. I didn't know where they were.
I have actually quite the apron collection. That was a new apron that my publicist had bought for me. But I had a great time on the show. It was a lot of fun. We got to make these strawberry and cream donuts, which are kind of like a strawberry shortcake. It's a yeast raised donut that you then slice horizontally and you fill with sliced strawberries, fresh strawberries and fresh whipped cream. So they almost are like a tropezienne, that pastry. And anyway, they're really delicious. And it's kind of a fun twist on a strawberry shortcake.
And how was it being on the show? Did they have a good set for cooking?
Yeah. They had actually a really nice kitchen
that
fully worked. And even better, they had a staff people. So they basically...
It's
staff. So actually, I made the donuts as we were on... You know, on screen, but all the donuts that were surrounding us had been made by the chef there. So she actually went through the cookbook and made a whole bunch of donuts from the book, and then we had piles of them everywhere, which was great. Everyone was congratulating me on the donuts, and I wanted to actually, it's Haley, the wonderful chef, you know, but so that was great. And the staff was really happy because there were just piles of fresh donuts around the set. So that was great.
The book hasn't been out long enough, but has anyone approached you and asked, there any gluten-free donuts?
You know, there actually are a few. There's a couple of gluten-free recipes, and I think there maybe is even a couple of baked donut recipes in there. Mm-hmm. So yes, it's definitely not a gluten-free book by any means, but if you need to make a gluten-free donut, there are some options in there.
What's the trick?
They actually work a little better if you're. I found the baked donut with doing a gluten-free actually works a little better because they're a little delicate to fry.
Yeah.
But and also making them maybe a little smaller, so you're not necessarily trying to make a full donut with the hole. Like maybe just kind of making almost like a little one that's not really shaped.
Yeah.
It's more like a drop donut.
Yeah. And it seems to me that around the world, not all donuts have holes.
No, no. Actually, that's a very American.
Beignets, of course,
beignets don't. You know, it's actually. I found the whole thing is a very American thing.
And the round what's donut. The story behind it?
Oh, there's about a million apocryphal stories, you know, of someone looking and saying that seeing that the donut always was raw in the middle and thinking, hey, if we take out the middle, you know, because of course then the oil comes up in the middle and it cooks actually much faster.
And then you can buy donut holes, which I was a little girl, that was my favorite.
Of course.
I love donut holes.
Yeah. I know, Munchkins, the Timbits, like everybody, you know, all the different companies have their names from the donut holes are the treat. So I actually found that making donuts at home is actually much easier than anybody thinks. And it's really fast and it's fun. And once you get your oil up to temperature, man, they fry
really fast.
You just, I mean, once I, you know, of course I had to wait a couple hours for the beignets to rise. But then once they were risen, drop them in the whole batch of, I don't know, about 16, you know, took me probably 5 minutes to fry, if that, you know, they're just popping in and they go. And plus it's just really fun because you think, it's dough, you know, and you just think, it's not going to make a donut, you know, and then you drop it in. You're
watching
like,
it swells up.
Yeah. Poof up and
really
turn
fun.
Brown. You're like, whoa, I just made a donut. You know?
Yeah. If you're used to only eating donuts that have come from somewhere else, it's sort of magical.
It is. And absolutely, especially if they've come either from a mix or they've come, you know, from 2 days ago, like having a really hot, fresh donut in your house is, you know, just brilliant. Mm. So,
What are Italian donuts? Do we have Italian donuts?
Yes, there's actually several in there. There's frittelle and there's bombolini and I think there's a little ricotta bacci. So they're a very moist, light dough made with ricotta and you just, they're very small. They're like little tiny balls. You just kind of fry them after dinner, you know, and serve them hot. And then the frittelle, which are made for St. Joseph's Day, which is sort of the Italian Father's Day, which is I think around sometime in mid-March, and they're small sweetened donuts that are then filled with a pastry cream and usually amarena cherries. And I think they have a little bit of a Sicilian, I think it's a Southern Italian thing.
Southern Italian.
They have a sort of Sicilian thing going on with those. I think there's maybe pistachios involved, you know, almost a little bit like a cannoli filling, that kind of thing.
Cannoli. I made 24 cannoli the other day.
Well, how come I don't just come over to your house all the time?
These were for a bunch of sixth graders. They had to do their big school report. Every child had to choose a region, preferably in Europe. And Lucas ended up choosing Sicily.
Well, he's a smart kid.
And he did it for three reasons. He knew he could crib off me because I've been there.
Right.
Francis Coppola and The Godfather, and he has loved cannolis since he couldn't say the word.
So
he says, if I do Sicily, will you
make
cannoli?
Cannoli? And you're like, okay, I can't say no to you, right?
Yeah, I will. So, I made them and then waved goodbye to all of them.
Oh,
I had a little bit of the filling left.
Right. What did you use in the filling?
Well, I did very simple. I'm really simple when it comes to cannoli. And I used the sheep ricotta from Bellwether Farms.
Oh, can we just have a moment in that sheep ricotta? Have you ever made it with the Zuni Cafe recipe for the gnocchi? The ricotta gnocchi?
I haven't, but I should.
It's simple and, oh my goodness, if you make it with that sheep ricotta, it is heaven.
That sheep ricotta. So, I mean, the ricotta in Sicily, that's reason enough to go.
Sure.
So I salted a little bit because they salted in, all the ricotta is salted in Sicily. Then I just did sugar, grated lemon zest, vanilla.
Because, of course, they have such wonderful lemons in Sicily, too, right?
Incredible citrus. And toasted pine nuts. That was it. I didn't do any chocolate chips. I didn't do any dried fruits.
Right.
Just really simple. And no chocolate. I know that Cousteau Bakery makes cannoli one day a year. You can pick them up on Christmas Eve. Yeah, Christmas Eve. And they do a chocolate blend.
Oh, sure.
But I was in Sicily. We were in Ragusa Ilba, and I was on a press trip. And they had been feeding us like they were fattening us for the kill.
Right.
And we were at this. It was the last fancy restaurant we were going to be going to until we got to Palermo. And the waiter came, and it was like, cannoli for all around. And it's like, no, I just can't eat another thing. And the guy, Adam, who was our leader, says, you can have some of mine. So it's like, okay, fine. So it arrived. He gave me a bite. It's one of the best things I've ever tasted in my life. And I turned my head to get another bite and it was gone. It was so, I still think about it. It was just so astonishingly good. And it was very simple. It didn't have
was it
no
the
chocolate.
Ricotta that made it so good?
Just yes, the- it was the ricotta. They just got the exact balance of sugar mm-hmm. and that the flavor blossoms so much with that little bit of salt.
Oh, of course.
A little bit of lemon zest. There could have been a little rose water.
Oh, sure.
I'm not sure.
I wouldn't there be surprised have, because yeah. there's still that those echoes of the kind of, you know, Moorish and
oh,
Arab.
Oh, a lot.
A lot in Sicily.
Yeah.
So definitely. That was something I saw a lot in researching that there's still all those echoes of that culture in Spain and in Sicily and in and around the Mediterranean.
Yeah. So Lucas got the before he turned in this report, I said, okay, I think you're old enough to watch The Godfather and make sure you watch for the part with the cannoli.
Right.
So he did. So he really appreciated the cannoli even more. So your book on cocktails is going to be out in the fall.
In the fall.
In
right.
the fall. You got to hurry and get that endorsement from
Rachel.
Rachel.
I know. Maddow. I know. Because I just am going through the final galleys now. So, you know, it's
okay.
It's,
there's time.
There's a little bit of time still.
Send an email.
Yeah.
Just send an email and make a good case like I know you can. It won't hurt. Can you say anything about what's next after that?
I have all kinds of ideas and I am shopping them around.
Okay.
And we'll see.
You and me both.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. But I would love to be writing more books. So, absolutely. Always more ideas mm-hmm. for sure.
We've got like 3 or 4 minutes left. In the last few weeks, because I know you're like me, you get tons of books coming across your desk all the time. Anything come recently that has really piqued your interest?
River Cottage Veg, which is actually by Hugh Fearnley Whittenstall, who is in Britain, who does the River Cottage books. And he actually is a big advocate for meat, usually, mm-hmm. but in sustainable meat. But he said he's sort of gone through a bit of a transformation, realizing that we need to eat less meat and we need to give more honor to the veg. And so he actually did a lovely book all about veg. No, it's a vegetarian book.
Uh-huh.
So that's been really fun. I also got a book called The Perfect Peach by David Masumoto.
Oh, and he has another book on peaches.
Right,
so
it's a beautiful. So this is a beautiful, beautiful book. I've just started reading it, and it's a story of, you know, it's his family and it's beautiful recipes, and it's more of a recipe book than just a. It's
well,
more
he's got a book out. Maybe he's
got a book out,
go
and it's yes, and it's brand new. It's, you know, I think it's from 10 Speed, and
I gotta get that.
Anyway, it's a beautiful book, and it's more of a cookbook than his previous books of essays.
Oh, cool.
So it's would be
right. I'll get in touch with 10 Speed.
Right.
They were just, I think
it's peach season.
Peach season, and we have Dry Creek peaches.
Right.
One of the people from 10 Speed was just up here with Deborah Madison. Have you seen her book?
Oh, yes, yes,
Vegetable
definitely.
Literacy.
Right,
yeah.
right.
I love that. I love the cover of that book.
Right, I know. Isn't it beautiful?
And I was really pleased to see that 10 Speed is supporting that kind of stuff now.
Definitely. No, I know. I think that book is just, you know, it's an introduction because not everybody, you know, remembers the Greens books and all that. So it's really
that's
nice
true.
To
that's
see, you know,
point.
So it's introducing her work to a new generation of cooks. So I'm really happy to see that book.
Well, on that note, Stephanie, the hour has whizzed by. And Stephanie's latest book, World of Cookbooks,
World of Donuts.
Gosh, World of Donuts, more than 50 delicious recipes from around the globe. It is really yummy. You can always pick it up and just take a bite. There are photographs. The recipes, really accessible. I can vouch for all of your recipes. Always work. It's one of the great things. And you'll come back and we'll have cocktails.
Even better. Okay. Thank you so much.
You bet. Meet me back here. Actually, I won't be here next week. There will be something yummy in my place, though. So I'll be here live in the studio 2 weeks from tonight. On Mouthful, the One Country's Most Delicious Hour. Have a great week.
Story. Well, children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough.
Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour, is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan, who also selects Mouthful's music. Live episodes are engineered by Michael Young and occasionally by Mary Moore Campagna. Mark Fuller is Mouthful's recording and post-production engineer. Podcasts are available at iTunes and krcb.org. For more information, to suggest a guest, and to find out how to be a guest yourself, email catsmilk@sonic.net or send a message via Mouthful's Facebook page.
Good cornbread. Listen to what the preacher says. Praises be.